Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed. We are now finished with the State versus Amanda Lewis series. However, today we have a special Toward Justice weekly bonus episode, Amanda Lewis Extras, because there's always stuff that we can't quite get into our season that we want to talk about. There's always questions that listeners have, and there's thoughts that I want to share as the season goes on. So today we're going to be covering as much of that stuff as we can. So as always, my name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I am here with my colleague, Colin Miller. Hi, Colin.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. And as Rabia noted, over the course of 11 episodes, we have dug deep into all the key details of the Amanda Lewis case. Once again, just setting the scene, back in 2008, Amanda was convicted by a jury of six of the drowning death of her seven-year-old daughter, Adriana. She has been in prison for the last 17 years, and we updated you in our very last episode. Based upon work done and research from this podcast, an appeal has been filed on behalf of Amanda, claiming four separate errors, each and every one of which we think should lead to her conviction being thrown out. And as Rabia noted in this follow-up episode, we have some things we want to address. We didn't touch upon these things for pacing. We have some questions from listeners, and so let's go ahead and dive into a first potentially huge issue or potentially non-issue.
So the first thing we want to talk about is the blood stains on the side of the pool. Now, we did not note in our coverage that there were blood stains on the pool, and that's because the state itself had no idea what to make of them. So let's start by reorienting you about the pool's positioning. The trailer where Amanda and Adriana live was at 3343 First Avenue South in Estill, Florida. And as we've noted, First Avenue South is an east-west street, and the trailer is on the south side of the street. When we talked about AJ's drawing of the drowning, we noted how the kid's wagon was pulled next to the northwest side of the pool. The defense theory and first responder Charles Corcoran's initial claim was that Adriana got into the wagon and then fell into the pool from the wagon. We also talked about how Amanda pulled Adriana out from the northeast portion of the pool, which is the other side from where the wagon was, and that's where she was performing CPR on Adriana when the first responders arrived. You might recall that in the drawing that Amanda's son AJ did during therapy, he drew his mom dunking his sister at the northeast side of the pool. And that has led to our belief that AJ misinterpreted his mom saving his sister as his mom drowning his sister.
So that then takes us to the southwest portion of the pool. This was neither where the wagon was, nor where Amanda pulled Adriana from the pool, nor where AJ drew his mom drowning his sister in the drawing. And so while they were processing the crime scene, as Rabia noted, law enforcement officers noted what appeared to be four blood stains on the southwest portion of the pool. And so at trial, the prosecution called Magda Clanton. She was the supervisor of the biology section of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and she testified at trial regarding these stains.
And it matched the DNA profile of the victim, Adriana Hutto, by comparison to the buccal swabs from the victim.
So that was Adriana's blood and those swabbings from the...
Well, FDLE has a policy where we don't state identity. So what we do is once it's determined that an unknown stain, like, for example, in this case, blood, is compared to a DNA profile from someone in the case, and in this case, it's the victim, and it matches, the next thing that's done is to determine how many other people besides the victim that DNA profile could also match. So statistics is performed on that match.
What were the statistics in this case, Matt?
Well, based upon the results, the frequency of occurrence of the DNA profile that was obtained from exhibits A1A, A2, and 2A1 for unrelated individuals in the following populations is approximately 1 in 22 quadrillion of the Caucasian population, 1 in 1.7 quintillion of the African American population, and 1 in 83 quadrillion of the Southeastern Hispanics population.
But if, in fact, we know that Adriana Elaine Hutto was a white Caucasian little girl, the statistics that would be relevant in this case would be the 1 in 22 quadrillion.
Yes, you can use that one. They're all extremely rare profiles.
So, you know, Rabia, looking at this, On the one hand, we have these four blood stains that belong to Adriana on the very pool in which she drowned. And so you might imagine this could be one of the critical pieces of evidence in this case. We need to know about it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we can't timestamp blood. So this could have come that day, days earlier, weeks earlier. And they weren't from where she was pulled from the pool. They weren't by the wagon. They're in a completely separate area. No blood was found on AJ, on Amanda. And so we have no idea when this blood was left, if it has anything to do with the crime or it's completely unrelated.
Well, I mean, the day of the drowning, though, when Adriana was pulled out of the pool, was she bleeding at that time?
No. She had the initial bruise on her forehead that led to the separate bruises that they thought was a hand.
Right.
There was an attempt to put a catheter into her when they're trying to resuscitate her. And they did that a few times and that led to an abrasion, but that was after she was in the pool. So
yeah,
there's no evidence of a cut or abrasion, which makes me think this is older and not related, but you never know.
Yeah. Does Amanda have any recollection of maybe a time like her daughter cut herself or why the bloodstains would have been there?
Yeah, I've never asked her. It's something we should maybe follow up on to see because certainly nothing that day would indicate that she was bleeding.
And the police never asked her when they questioned her about the bloodstains. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess, like you said, they didn't know what to do with it because there's no source of the blood to be found anywhere. They don't know what it's about.
Right.
All right. A second issue that we did not touch on was like animal friends. And, you know, we've noted how a few of our inmates have found some solace in prison from working with animals. For example, we did a series on Jonathan Irons, who was wrongfully convicted for over 23 years before having his conviction reversed and being released shortly after we covered his case. Well, while he was behind bars, he got to train dogs and he loved the experience. Now he's the founder of Dogs We Trust, LLC, and that helps people train their dogs. Well, in 2024, Amanda got a good behavior transfer to a new prison. And to her surprise and joy, it was filled with animal friends that have been a spot of hope on top of Amanda helping other inmates with their cases.
So you mentioned one bright spot and spot of hope that you find in prison is helping the other inmates with their cases.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you have any of your friends with you today, but I also understand from talking with other people in our prior Zoom that you have some animal friends there in prison. And so what can you tell us about your animal friends there in prison?
Oh my goodness. Well, I do have a lizard. Her name is Layla. We have ducks. I would probably be in confinement if I did what I wanted to, which would just have them all in my room. But yes, there's ducks, there's iguanas, we have geese, there is a peacock. It's anybody that has a lot of time to do, I think should do it here. But this to me is an awesome compound. I have found so much peace here. And it feels like since I've gotten here, it's like feeling a little bit closer to freedom, a little bit more prepared.
Right.
For being able to go home.
Yeah, so Robbie, I don't know about you, but this to me feels like one of the more important things that correctional facilities can do. I think Joy Watkins had a similar experience in Georgia prison because working with rescue animals, training them to be companion animals, emotional support animals. Again, we've seen it in our cases. I've seen some reporting elsewhere. I think it really helps people become rehabilitated and help them to reenter society and find compassion for both innocent and guilty people who are in prison.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I feel like it's just like, you know, whether or not it rehabilitates people, I feel like just the sense of comfort that animals bring.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like we hear about this, like even in nursing homes, that there are programs that will take, you know, animals in to visit with sick children in hospitals or nursing homes for the elderly. There's just something about it. I mean, like I'm a cat lover and I've got cats and I'm like, anytime I'm stressed, I need them purring up next to me. But anyhow, it is wonderful that Amanda's been involved in that. And even what Jonathan Irons has done with his organization is fantastic. Before we get some listener questions, I wanted to share a couple of things that, and, you know, as Colin and I record, you know, look, this was Colin is lead investigator and reporter on this case, and he did the scripting, and that's just how we operate. I'll be lead reporter investigator on the next season, which will drop, I think, late next spring, hopefully. And as I'm reading his script and we're, you know, recording every week, there are so many times when I just find myself like exclaiming because I can't help it. Mm-hmm. I'm a mom. I've raised three children. I know exactly what little kids are like. And I think Colin's even seen me like break out into tears at times because I'm like, I can't imagine being Amanda and watching her son struggle through having to testify, knowing that her son has now been one way or the other, like believes in this narrative that his mother killed his sister and having to live with that her whole life. But there's so many times I remember like when you were talking about, well, who was the witness who said the kids were always hungry? Like this was all went back to Amanda being a bad mom.
This is Podchuck. This is the husband of Amanda's mother who had an acrimonious relationship with Amanda and according to her made advances on her, the Amanda Rebuff shortly before the drowning.
Oh, I mean, look, if you have had kids, especially that age, kids are always hungry. All kids are always hungry. I mean, I cannot tell you, like my son, he is 8 years old. He will finish dinner and 15 minutes later, he's in the pantry. I'm like, what are you doing? And we have, you know, his friends who come over and these kids are well-fed kids. They are not impoverished children, but they just clean me out and go home. And that's just how it is. Kids are always hungry. They're always moving. They have high metabolisms. And what's also crazy to me is the fact that I know that people involved in this case, prosecutors, investigators, others involved, they have kids. They know what kids are like. Like, you're telling me that you actually, and you know, there was one of the pictures we used for the title image shows their house. And it is not at all an unkempt house. It looks like a house that's got some kids in it, kids playing in it. It looks like a clean house. And I just, it kills me that investigators went in there and these are people who grew up in their own homes as children. They probably have children and were like, yeah, we're going to say that this was a bad mom, you know. I don't know. There are so many times I've been so frustrated and upset. And then, you know, going back also over and over again to the question of AJ lying. AJ was telling the best truth that he knew. Kids can't tell the truth, the difference between truth and lies. Anyhow, these are some of the thoughts I had about just like how children behave in general. We did a bonus episode that was for our patrons. And in that episode, I think we addressed one of the questions got from one of our listeners, which I think is important. We should address it now, too. And that is the question of then how do you handle child witnesses then? Like if they are not that credible and you know that they might not be able to distinguish truth from fiction, what do you do then in these situations, Colin? What is the best practice then?
Yeah. And so two things. One was done here, but belatedly, and that is to have someone with expertise in interviewing children present. And so we noted that AJ had two interviews the day that his sister drowned. Right. The first was with two police officers, and then hours later was with Sarah Campbell of the Child Protection Team. And it's night and day in terms of the propriety of the questions. And in the police officer interview, he says, my mom drowned my sister. In the interview with the child protection team member, he says, I couldn't see my sister being dunked. I was in the garbage pantry in the front of the house. And so that's one. And then as Dr. Klemfis from UC Irvine said during our episode, which was, you know, shocking to me, Robbie, I was thinking, as someone who's taught evidence for decades, the oath is perfunctory.
You're right.
Every witness gets there, they put their hand in the Bible or do whatever non-religious affirmation they want, and they promise to tell the truth. No big deal, they're going to do whatever they're going to do. But Dr. Klemfis spoke to, for child witnesses in particular, this is important and more important than the type of competency evaluation that was done for AJ, and to really impress upon the child, look, this is serious, you need to tell the truth. And then also, for AJ especially, telling the child witness, if you don't know the answer to a question, say you don't know. Don't fill in what you think people want you to hear, what you've come up with. If you don't know the answer, say, I don't know.
Yeah. I can completely understand why an oath would have such an impact on a child. It's like a pinky promise.
Yeah.
It's like they really believe in the power of words at that age. I mean, my son, like I said, he's 8 years old. When he's not listening, if I say I'm going to count to three, and he has never seen what happens after three, because by three he's up and doing. But it's just the power of that, you know what I mean? Because but he has, and I don't even know what I'm going to do after three, because we've never gotten to that point. So that makes a lot of sense. But you know, again, like, you can give that child an oath. That child can be like, I don't know, But what do you do if that child, having been spoken to by police officers and other like grandpas and all random people, doesn't know anymore what actually, doesn't remember correctly what happened? And like, so their recall, they think they're telling the truth. They think they know. They're not going to say, I don't know, because they're like, yeah, I know, I did see her do X, Y, Z, because they can't distinguish what actually happened from the memories that have been created through other people's suggestions and stuff. I mean, I was thinking about this because I was thinking about, you know, how do you deal with, well, I was actually speaking to a prosecutor yesterday. I'm going to LA in a couple of weeks, and I'm speaking to a group of prosecutors and law students and other folks. And we were talking about the issue of like unreliable witnesses. And he's like, you know, it's good to set up some better practices for prosecutors. And I said, how about simple as if you have an unreliable witness, meaning their statements have changed over time, make sure you can either corroborate it or be like, we can't rely on this. And so all the evidence that could have corroborated AJ, like, just didn't exist, right? We know he was in a tree. Like, you broke it down how it was an impossibility for AJ to have really seen anything. And all the evidence shows that he could not have seen what the state decided he did. So the lack of corroboration with an unreliable witness, I think, should just be enough to, like, not allow that testimony. Holiday season is upon us, and so is gift-giving season, and I want to suggest to you one of my favorite gifts ever to give, especially if you have family or loved ones who are really far apart from you, and that is the Aura Frame. The Aura Frame is a digital frame, and it's something that I gifted to my father many years ago before he passed away, and it was one of his favorite things. When he was hospitalized, he took the Aura Frame with him. When he was in rehab, he took it with him. That Aura Frame stayed with him until the day he passed away, because Aura Frames keep family members connected even if you're miles apart or if that family member feels like they're miles apart from you. Aura Frames are featured in 495 gift guides in 2024 alone. It has been selected 3 times as one of Oprah's favorite things, and it is the number one digital picture frame by Wirecutter, The Strategist, Wired, and PC Mag. It's been recommended by Good Morning America, The Today Show, Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and me. It only takes a couple of minutes to set up a frame using the Aura app. So you'll have the app, you'll have complete control over who has access to your frame, and the Aura app lets you share pictures more securely than with email. You can also upload videos up to 30 seconds long, and your favorite live iPhone photos play right on the frame, and the embedded speaker can play audio on demand. Aura frames have meticulously calibrated high-resolution displays. And you can react to the pictures with cute emojis to show you how you love a picture, send congratulations, and more. The Aura Frame was one of my father's most cherished treasures, and I promise it will be for anybody that you give it to. That's because even though you can't wrap togetherness, you can frame it. Now, for a limited time, visit AuraFrames.com and get $45 off Aura's best-selling Carver mat frames. They're named number one by Wirecutter just by using the promo code JUSTICE at checkout. That's AuraFrames.com, promo code JUSTICE. This exclusive Black Friday Cyber Monday deal is their best of the year, so order now before it ends and support our show by mentioning us at checkout. Terms and conditions apply.
It's really interesting, and it's something I just was teaching my evidence students, which is sort of the history of competency, which is, if you go back centuries, a lot of categories of witnesses, including children.
And women too, right?
Oh, yeah. Women, spouses, people with felony convictions were just deemed automatically incompetent to testify.
Yeah.
And then you see a gradual shift to, for certain witnesses, having, as you said, a corroboration requirement. And then the modern trend started in the 70s with the passage of the Federal Rules of Evidence is, we trust juries. Let's go ahead and have most witnesses competent to testify, and through cross-examination and probing their qualifications, the jury will be able to sort out who is lying and who's telling the truth. The jury is the lie detector, not the actual polygraph. And I think that this case in particular, as you know, Ravia, kind of calls into question that conventional wisdom and says, you know, maybe we should be more particular about who gets to take that stand.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the thing. It's like, there's a judge and these adults, you know, prosecutors, they're watching this child testify. That child is contradicting himself repeatedly, right? Mm. At some point, why isn't the judge or the prosecutor are like, listen, we just in good faith cannot do this. Clearly. I mean, like, we got to stop this. We can't. I don't understand why nobody in the system is like, it reminds me of like when Christina Gutierrez went off the rails during Adnan's closing at this, especially at the second trial. I mean, she really was incoherent, but you know, she was getting more so over the course of the trial anyways. And I remember looking around and saying, all these people know her. They've known her and how she has been in a courtroom for decades. Why isn't anybody stopping this and saying something's wrong? Something's wrong.
Yeah, we had a comment from Joseph Ruskovich, I think this was on Twitter, about it appearing from your podcast that judges will never admit they are wrong or make themselves look bad. Judge Register was unwilling to change his ruling. And so we kind of laid this out, Ravi. I think you were the one who explained this in the episode, where we have this a lot in trials, where the judge says, I'm making a preliminary ruling.
Right.
If something changes at trial, I'll change my ruling. Mm-hmm. Judge Register didn't, and the judge almost never does, despite the fact that he said, I'll change my ruling if AJ starts saying inconsistencies. He did, and he said, well, inconsistencies don't matter. It's really tough, judicial inertia, to get that judge to say, my initial ruling was wrong. With the new evidence, I'm going to change what I did. It's just tough to get them to change. They're often stuck in their ways.
I wonder if that's an ego thing for the judge, or if it's like, as he's hearing the opening and he's getting into the case, he's like, well, I kind of think she did it too. And, you know, it's they're human beings at the end of the day. They're not like, you know, robots. They have to, you have to account for their emotions, like somehow affecting what they're doing. But also, I wanted to ask you something else. A lot of our cases are such that we're like, man, if this had happened like today or in the last couple of years, it wouldn't have turned out like this because technology has changed, you know, protocols have changed. Do you think if this had been a more recent case, it could have been a different outcome? Was it like, for example, has there been new science? Has there been like, what do you think? Or do you think it kind of would have ended up the same given the circumstances, like the fact that Amanda had lost a child before and she was a single mom and all that stuff?
Yeah, I think there's kind of two big things, which is we noted one, the confrontation clause now says you can't have a surrogate medical examiner, which is what was done here. And without that, I don't know that the jury convicts. And then second, the whole science around drowning was just starting to change around 2008. And this is something that was brought up to say, well, Dr. Siebert, the medical examiner who was disgraced, came to these conclusions, but here's some new studies that just came out. And then Dr. Siebert never had to address them because he didn't appear at trial. And so I think the science has changed in terms of drowning. And we've presented, both through an interview and some quotes from anonymous doctors, conclusions that the bruises on Adriana's face are not consistent with a human hand. And so that kind of discredits the whole theory. And so I think the science would be very different today in the courtroom.
Yeah.
I don't know that it would change the jurors hearing AJ and having to think in their heads, is he lying and saying his mom did this when she didn't? That's, it's tough when you have that child to discredit and disbelieve what they're saying.
Yeah. I mean, look, I don't believe anything kids say. I'm like, you know.
Depends on your jurors, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Because I just don't. And I know that it's like I have to independently verify like what's being told to me. But I think what it is like, and we talked about this in, I think we talked about this in a bonus episode, or I can't remember, but that it was probably a combination of not just AJ being up there, but also what they believed was actual like CSI type of science. But I also think the fact that the jury was allowed to know about the previous child, you know, the death of
They actually weren't. They weren't allowed to know about the
it was excluded.
Yeah, that was excluded from the trial. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. But that was that in the media? Where was that? Like there was some...
Yeah, it was mentioned in the media, and that was one of our questions in talking to the jurors is, had they heard that?
Okay.
Turned out they hadn't heard that, but they had heard from Mike Aureli in the supermarket saying, you know, Amanda
supposedly
abused drugs and therefore was a bad mother. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, I'm sure that did lead, however, to the fact, I mean, the police were focused on, like, this woman has done this before and she'll do it again. All right. So we have some listener questions, too. I'll let you set up what Ashley asked to say.
Yeah, this is interesting. Ashley C. asked, I wonder what leverage the police had over that supervisor and coworker to get them to testify to these out-of-context incidents. And so, Rabia, this is referring to The one incident at work where her supervisor said that Amanda said I could just kill Adriana because she had used a permanent marker to write loser in Amanda's Chevy Cavalier. And the other coworker saying Amanda would say at work, I never fully bonded with Adriana. I was called away for army duty after she was born. We had this period of separation, so I had difficulty bonding with her during that period in time. And so to answer this question, the prosecution has subpoena power, and so they were able to subpoena these witnesses and get them to testify. What I found interesting, Robbie, we'll go through this now, is there were multiple other coworkers who were spoken to by the police, and the defense didn't call them at trial, but they paint a very different picture that I think would have been important for the jury to hear. So one of them was Marcy McGrath. She told the police that Amanda got along well with her coworkers, the patients liked her, and that Amanda talked about both of her kids all the time. She said that Amanda talked about loving her kids, never had a bad word about them. At the end of her statement, when asked whether she wanted to add anything else, she said, quote, "I mean, she's a good person. She's a good mama. As far as I knew, she was a good mama." We had a second coworker, Robin Morris. She said very similar things. Amanda was a good worker. She was good with the patients. She talked about loving her kids, never spoke poorly about them. In a final comment, she stated, "She seems like a really good person. She's always been very caring toward the patients." And then this kind of might sum up a lot of our listeners' thoughts at the end of this series. There was this third coworker, Audrey Powell, again said Amanda was a good worker, caring with patients, got along with everyone, talked about her kids quite a lot, seemed like a loving mother, talked about doing things with her kids, taking them places. And then, Robbie, if you can lead this last comment that the coworker Audrey Powell told the police when she was questioned by them.
All right, here's what it says. "I just think this whole investigation is ridiculous. I know there's a little girl dead and there's a lot of questions going on, but I think Amanda is a good person and she loved her children, and I just don't believe that she had anything to do with her death."
So how important, Robbie, we heard from these two witnesses, the supervisor and the coworker, again, speaking to this marker incident, I could just kill her, and then the other one saying never fully bonded with her because of our period of separation. In your mind, how important or unimportant would it have been for these other coworkers to provide this type of testimony at trial?
I mean, look, I definitely couldn't have hurt for sure, right? I think the defense failed its duty by not calling them. I don't know why they didn't call them. But I will say this, is there's something about human nature that you can present like 100 good, things. And then one thing that's, And we judge other people like this all the time. Somebody can be good on for 20 different reasons, but if there's one thing that they did or said, that'll kind of stick with you. I don't know this. It's just human nature. So I don't know. And I don't know if it would have helped too much. It doesn't mean it shouldn't have been done. They definitely should have been called. I don't know. I guess as character witnesses, but I also think about the fact that investigators were like, we talked to all the different people, and almost everybody said that she was a good mom, but we're just going to go ahead and go with these two.
And that's the comment, right? Yeah, this is out of context in the sense that these people had worked alongside her for months or years, and they're extracting, one incident where with permanent markers she writes loser in the car. Anyone's going to be upset.
Look, I cannot tell you how many times I've been like, that's it. I am abandoning my children and disappearing. I have done enough mothering. I do not want to be a mother today. We all have these very human moments. We all have moments where we're like texting our significant other. That's it. I'm killing you when you come home. I mean, but the scary thing is all of this stuff can be used against you in a court of law at some point. So you almost have to be careful what you say to who you say it to. But I don't know. Did the defense ever explain why they didn't call them? Is it because they figured it's not going to make a difference anyways? Because
I think
people,
so.
I figure the same thing, too.
And they called the teacher. Adriana's teacher was quite helpful to Amanda, saying she's a loving mother, concerned with her child, was not neglectful, et cetera. So maybe he thought that was enough.
I mean, I would think that teacher would have much more weight than the mother's coworkers. Because think about, if you're a parent, how much do your coworkers really know? They might know what you're telling them, but they probably have never actually seen you actually interact with your kids, unless they're coming to your house or your kids are going to work. They're not going to see that. But this teacher sees this little girl every single day.
And it's a small class,
It's a small class. They see her every single day. And teachers who have been teaching for years have a very good sense of the kids who need some help, kids who are not in a good place, kids who are being neglected. You can tell. They can tell. And so, yeah, I can understand that kind of calculation. Like, it probably wouldn't have helped. But I do think also kind of leaving a vacuum was not a good idea. Like, it couldn't have hurt is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
I think it, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So this is a username, KKPrince1008, who says, you can dry drown. All right. So as we noted, the prosecution pushed the theory that Adriana couldn't have accidentally drowned in the pool because she was taller than the water. But we explained through statistics and talking with the drowning expert, John Fliedemeyer, that a child drowning in water that they're taller than in is just not surprising at all, especially if, like Adriana, they really don't know how to swim. But John Fliedemeyer also did discuss dry drowning as a possibility in this unaired portion of the interview. So listen to this.
There's a reflex that will cause basically your lungs to shut down, and it's called a dry drowning. Mm-hmm. And if water comes in touch with the esophagus, it's rare, and it's debatable if it even happens, but I think there's enough evidence that it does happen that you can, once it sets off a reflex reaction which shuts down the lungs and you can no longer breathe. And that can happen in almost any depth of water.
There are witnesses in this case who say, this was a young girl, she was just learning how to doggy paddle, and they say a couple of weeks ago, she was in the pool and she was trying to dunk her head underwater and she kept her mouth open. And she did this a couple of times and she came up and she was coughing out water because she didn't, you know, close her mouth and she was taking in water. What effect would that have if she had fallen in the water and kept her mouth open and was taking in water?
That could initiate that reflex that I'm not doing a very good job describing, but that can initiate that, and in theory can cause a dry drowning.
And we have some other comments in this context too. We have Chuck Hoey also from Facebook. I worked as a lifeguard and taught swimming lessons back in the 20th century.
So old.
And this is kind of the point, the whole like disputed trial. He says a child can both enjoy wearing floaties and swim with family and be afraid of going underwater. A child can have some fear of the water without being scared of getting leaves in the pool. And then we had Heidi Walbieski, isn't it possible she just hit her head after falling into the pool and lost consciousness? This is something else, Rabia, where I think the science is finally starting to catch up to what's going on out there in the law, in the courtrooms, which is for years and decades, you have prosecutions saying, how in the world could this person innocently drown? They're taller than the waterline. And if anything, I hope this series is an education to people listening who will be jurors in the future that absolutely any person, and certainly a child who doesn't know how to swim, can and does drown in water that is lower than their mouth line.
But Colin, once again, what makes me angry about that fact that we have to actually explain this is that I'm not a swimmer. I don't know how to swim. And because I'm not a swimmer, I know that my 5'3" of body can easily drown in 3 feet. Yeah. I have been in a pool where I'm like at 3 feet, my foot has slipped, I've gone underwater, and I'm panicking and flailing. And my friend is standing next to me saying, Rabia, just stand up. All you gotta do is stand up. But I can't because I'm panicked. Everybody knows that. I refuse to believe that these people don't know that if one of these investigators is 6 feet tall, you're telling me you can't drown in 5 feet of water? Of course you could.
In between college and law school, I worked at a summer camp, and one of the things I did was teach the kids swimming. And to your point exactly, that's the difference between an experienced swimmer and a novice is when you learn how to swim, oh, I'm very smooth in my strokes. I have my wits about myself. I know I can stand if something's going wrong. When you put someone who doesn't know how to swim into water, they're flailing. They're not thinking. And that's why they don't get vertical. And so
I can't even float. I can't. If I have been told by instructors, if you just calm down, you'll float. I'm like, I cannot. And I have attempted this many times in my life. And now I'm like, I give up. I will never be a swimmer. I cannot get over the panic. I don't know why. And so we all kind of should instinctively know this. And it is crazy to me that all these grown-ups who were involved in this prosecution were like, well, of course she couldn't have drowned because the water wasn't as tall as her. This is a little girl who's scared of water to begin with and can't really swim.
And I have this question, Rabia, too, because this is interesting. I mean, it's something I've always thought, but I wonder your take on it, which is, this is from El Umunho, I think from Facebook as well. Not that it matters, because it absolutely didn't happen like that, but no one would drown or dunk anyone, especially their own child, face up. So in other words, what she's saying is, if you're going to drown someone, your hand is against the back of their head and you're pushing their face down. You're not doing it in the front of the face where they could bite you.
Grab your hand with their hands.
Yeah.
The other thing. You're telling me that this child just laid there prone while she's being put. You know, she did nothing with her arms, legs, kicking. When you're upside down, it's much harder to fight back.
Correct. Yeah, and so I agree with El Manojo that, yeah, this is not the way anyone would drown.
There are cases, and people have drowned in their bathtubs. We know this. Whitney Houston allegedly drowned in her bathtub. I mean, we know this, so. Have you gotten all the gifts you need for this upcoming holiday season? I know you might be stressed about it, but Uncommon Goods takes the stress out of gifting with thousands of unique, high-quality finds you're not going to see anywhere else. Don't wait, because the most meaningful gifts get scooped up fast, and now is the perfect time to cross names off your list. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many of them are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, making every single gift feel meaningful and truly be one of a kind. Uncommon Goods has something for everybody, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers, history buffs, and diehard football fans to foodies, mixologists, and avid gardeners. You will find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. I found a repurposed cotton sari robe on Uncommon Goods that I have just really never seen before. It is beautiful. And listen, as a South Asian brown girly, I love me a sari that's been repurposed. And I love that I'm supporting artists and small independent businesses with my purchases, like this sari robe. But here's the thing. A lot of their handcrafted products are made in small batches. So that sari robe might be on their website today, but gone tomorrow. So you got to shop now before they sell out this holiday season. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They have donated more than $3.1 million to date. So don't wait. Cross those names off your list before the rush. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/justice. That's uncommongoods.com/justice for 15% off. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. You know, I was going to say something about the science part of this, and it's something I've just been thinking about for quite a while now. And I don't know how to articulate this, but I don't think there is any other field, any other industry or field in the world in which people are forced to accept as fact science that is outdated. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Like, let's say I got a diagnosis on a medical condition 20 years ago. That does not get preserved in tar. So that every other doctor I see for the next 20 years says, well, that was your diagnosis and that's going to be the treatment because that's what we said 20 years ago. Things change. I mean, like the way you build buildings change, the way we have safety protocols, everything changes. Food standards change. Everything changes with time, and we accept that in every single field but the law. The law is the only place where if somebody decided this is what the scientific explanation is for this event, 25 years ago, no matter how outdated and how disproven it becomes, we have to accept that it is what it is. It is so frustrating to me.
Yeah.
This idea of finality. And I know this, maybe I'm taking us on a tangent, but Colin, I learned about finality back in law school, but that was a long time ago. I still don't understand it. Why is that so important? Because that's a big part of why we get so much resistance in trying to get these convictions overturned.
Yeah. And a few states have started passing these junk science statutes, including Texas. There's a case of a pending execution of a father who was convicted under the theory of shaken baby syndrome, which right. I've done a lot of research on. It's junk science. And so he might be executed or he might have his conviction overturned. Virginia tried to pass a junk science statute and it was shot down. To your point, Rabia, this idea of finality in the law, I mean, I get it. You want to have...
Why? Why do you get it? Tell me. Why?
The victim... Well, and look, this ties into the start of this series and Adnan Syed and Haman Lee and her family, right? The whole dispute that led to his conviction being reinstated was this idea of not disturbing finality and wanting the victim's family to have this solace and be able to rest in peace and not reopen these old wounds. And then the counter argument is, as you just raised, we're relying upon science that is outdated. We're relying upon, in many cases, witnesses who have recanted. We're relying upon non-unanimous juries. We're relying upon six-person juries that are outdated as well. And so, I mean, there's some virtue to finality. I get that. But I don't see how finality stands in the face of things that are obviously wrong under a 2025 microscope.
I just think the sacredness of my finality is ridiculous. I mean, finality only makes sense if we can say for sure we never, ever get it wrong. Simple as that. And because we can't, it's a relic, a legal relic that I think has to be reconsidered. But anyway, all right. What else? We've got Aaron Dylan Bailey, who says, as a former CPS worker, I keep thinking of things from that perspective, and I just don't understand. I'd be thrilled to see a house like that. Urine smells, pretty common. Only a few toys, that's fine. A pool out back, bougie. Mom has a job, awesome. Yep. I mean, yeah, I agree, Dylan. I think it's, to me, it seemed like Amanda was a really good mom. I mean, like, I don't know what else to say.
And she specifically took her most recent job so she could bring her kids into work and drop them off for school and pick them up. And so she was A, working, and B, had a job that she specifically tailored so that she could be involved in her kids' education. As her teacher said, she would come have lunch with Adriana. She would attend parent-teacher conferences. She would call about her daughter's progress. At a minimum, she was a very involved mother in her children's education.
Yeah. I mean, on that front, she was better than, because I never have time to go to a PTA. I've never been to a PTA meeting in my life. There, I said it. I mean, I don't have time because I'm working constantly and it's hard. So I'm like, no, the teacher's got it, you know, on lockdown, and the other parents, I trust them and everything will be fine at school. Call me if there's an emergency is how I am usually. But I think Amanda was doing an incredible job. But I also think there is the idea that, you know, she lived in a trailer. I mean, it was clean. It was well kept. She had the kids had outdoor space. You know what I mean? I love the fact that she's like, you don't get all the toys at once. That's the right thing to do. You put some away. You donate some. You give them a little bit of time. Otherwise, kids don't care. When they're surrounded by it, none of it's valuable to them anymore. Like, all parents know that. But also encouraging them to go outside, play in a tree. I think that's the right way to do it. So we agree with you, Aaron. Moving on, a question about the timeline. You want to set that up?
Yeah, and so we had a question from Shampede One. So far, it seems crazy they would disregard two adults, or however old boyfriend's son is, whose stories corroborate each other and are anchored objectively by some of the cell phone records, but instead double down on a five-year-old's version of events. I mean, for me, Rabia, the phone record here is critical because that's just an objective fact. We know at 2:30 p.m. on the day of the drowning, while inside the trailer, Amanda called her boyfriend Alan at his supermarket job. He's a meat cutter there.
Right.
We know from the drowning expert that at the earliest, Adriana is in the pool between 2:27 and 2:28. We know from Earl Wells, the neighbor, that he drove by the trailer shortly before the drowning. Again, at the earliest, Adriana is in the pool between 2:27 and 2:28. And so this was one of the critical things for me, is breaking down the timeline and just showing there is no time for Amanda to do this drowning,
right,
go inside, fabricate this alibi, as Larry Bashford says, call Alan, get AJ from the garbage can, try to get Adriana. There's just not time. And so it's just a matter of physical impossibility that she could have committed this drowning based upon this anchoring event of the cell phone call.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah, you know, Shampede, when we see this over and over again, where investigators, if they have made a decision, do you think this is a tunnel vision type of issue as well? Because I feel like this is what happens when they get tunnel vision early on. They make the decision and then they start ignoring all the evidence to the contrary and just focusing on whatever supports their theory.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, it's a lot of people cite to Occam's razor in these wrongful conviction cases, mm-hmm. right? The the likeliest explanation is the actual explanation. And so they say, oh, a child died. Likeliest explanation is the parent is the one who dunked her in the pool.
But see, in this situation, it to me, Occam's razor would be that it was an accidental drowning. She fell into the pool. It's so obvious.
Which is what Charles Corker, the first responder, said, yeah. Right? And so actually, I guess, let me correct myself. I was saying, you know, they get that tunnel vision in that way. Well, in this case, no, actually, the first responder said he thought she fell in from the wagon. So they had to change themselves up from that. So I would say then it comes to Pa Chuck, the grandmother's husband, who we know faxed the records of Amanda's first son having passed away. And we heard on 2020 Larry Bassford saying that was critical for me. And so I think it was this horrible death from seizure disorder that ended up kind of leading to them locking in on her.
Oh, boy. All right. Our next question comes from Nathan Farrell, who has a question about the Confrontation Clause, right? He says that I find it bizarre that the USA has a Sixth Amendment and that when people aren't afforded that right, you have to make sure that you include it in your appeal the first time. Otherwise, the legal system sees it as being waived. That is correct.
This is going back to the issue of finality, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people forget, but Adnan won on the cell tower disclaimer.
Mm-hmm.
It was thrown out because his appeal was not raised the first time, that issue.
Yeah.
It was deemed to be waived. Terrence Lewis, whose case we covered out of Philadelphia, he had to drop his appeal to get juvenile resentencing, similar to Adnan.
Okay.
Luckily for him, he appeared before the judge, and the judge said, I don't care about the rules. You're innocent. I'm going to throw out your conviction.
Oh.
Now he started the Liberation Foundation and is helping other wrongful convicted people. And so here, as I teed up in the episode, Amanda has an absolutely winning Confrontation Clause issue. But even with constitutional rights, recently the Supreme Court said you have to have a unanimous guilty verdict, all jurors voting guilty for a person to be convicted. Oregon and Louisiana used to allow for non-unanimous verdicts. And the Supreme Court says, well, this applies going forward, but if you were convicted 10-2 back in 2006, your conviction stands. Mm. It goes back to finality again, right? We're saying this is not a proper way to convict, and yet we're going to keep these convictions in place under this system that we're now finding is unconstitutional.
I mean,
doesn't make a lot of sense.
It's not always like that, right? There are certain.
Sometimes you can.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes you're like, okay, there's this new ruling and it applies to like something that happened before. So now I can like appeal based on this new, you know, whatever issue. And sometimes, you know, retroactively, when a court decides that this cannot be used retroactively, like, is that because it's something that's been legislated or how do they distinguish what can be used and what can't be used?
There's this test about like whether it's a watershed rule of criminal procedure. And so like they get into like this, what's critical to your right to a fair trial versus what's not.
Oh.
And so Confrontation Clause has been deemed not critical. And they kind of have to say that because the law and the Confrontation Clause has changed so much over the past two decades that if they did have it retroactively, a lot of wrongful convictions would be overthrown.
Yeah. I know a lot of you listening to this show are exactly where I've been for a number of years, which is in the sandwich generation. You've got little ones to take care of. You've got teenagers to take care of. You've got elderly parents to take care of. And guess what? Nobody takes a backseat except for you and your healthcare. And I know I've experienced this myself. Anytime my healthcare feels more complicated than I can handle right now, I just kind of back burner it. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to deal with all the insurance complexities. And for a lot of us, that area of being stuck is often related to the thing that we obsess about the most, which is weight-related issues. Because weight-related issues are not just about your appearance. They're about your quality of life. They're about your mobility. They're about your longevity. They're about so many other things. Now, for the last couple of years, a number of weight loss drugs have emerged. I know a number of friends who've been on GLP-1s and have seen incredible results. But even getting on those is daunting. Does my insurance cover it? Does it not cover it? How expensive are they? Well, that is where Roe comes in. Roe is a company that can help assess whether you are right for GLP-1s, but they will make the process easy, online, discreet, and they will check if your insurance will cover it for free. All you have to do to see if you are covered is submit your insurance card, and Roe will take care of the rest. There is no paperwork, no hassle, no waiting on hold. Roe's free insurance checker will send you a comprehensive report of your coverage details so that you can then make a decision that's right for your goals. In fact, nearly half of all Roe members have insurance coverage. And if you decide to move forward, Roe can help you understand GLP-1s like Ozempic and Wegovy, whether or not they're right for you and your goals. But that's just the beginning. When you become a Roe member, you will have support throughout the process. You'll have access to your provider on demand for any questions. So join the over 500,000 people who have trusted Roe to check their coverage for free. Go to roe.co/justice for your free insurance check. That's ro.co/justice to see if your insurance covers GLP-1s for free. Because there is no time like the present to take yourself off that back burner and prioritize your health. Go to roe.co/safety for boxed warning and full safety information about GLP-1 medications. So I see this question from Aaron, and we kind of did talk a little bit about this already. The credibility of a child witness. Is there more you want to add from here?
This is about AJ's credibility, and there was something we didn't mention on this series, and I feel like it fits better in this format.
Okay.
And it's also because we can't corroborate it. And so one of AJ's teachers was interviewed by the police. And according to her, AJ said that Adriana would come into his room with a knife at night and say she was going to kill him. And after she relayed this to the police, she added, and you know, whether it was true or not, I don't know. And so I don't think Adriana threatened AJ's life with a knife. The teacher certainly didn't report this in the sense that we have to investigate this and protect him. But we can't confirm or dispel it. And so in my mind, I would say, Rabia, this is another pretty serious story created by AJ going to death and killing. But yeah. I didn't know what your thoughts about. I mean, I've never heard of a child saying something so serious that their sibling, a young, you know, 7-year-old sister, threatened to kill them with a knife. I think it's made up. But I don't know.
I mean, if something like that happened ever, I can only imagine it happening because they saw it on TV or they, you know what I mean? Like she or either he's making up a story, attributing it to his sister, but it's something he saw on TV or heard adults talking about. That's not something that naturally occurs to a child, or that Adriana herself saw it on TV and then mimicked it. I mean, clearly nobody thought there was a real danger here. And it's interesting that... I mean, I don't know. I wonder how the police felt about that when they heard this. I mean, I guess they're like, well, this is, we got to like dismiss this. There's nothing really we can do with this. I'm surprised. I mean, they could have really twisted and been like, well, yeah, she's learning this from her mother because her mother maybe threatens her with an, I mean, I don't know. Like, this is kind of like the atmosphere of the house. You could use this in lots of different ways. I think, you know, the little kids can have, especially I've seen this more with little boys and little girls, have incredible, crazy imaginations. And I know that, like, I went to this little a gathering last night. There's this kid sitting in front of me, and he was this little 6-year-old kid, and he's drawing in a notebook. And I'm, like, watching what he's drawing, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's the kind of stuff my son draws. And it's always, like, it's always little boys, but it's always, like, monsters with blood spurting out of their eyes and like fangs, and where this is coming from, I don't know. My kid doesn't get to watch, you know, horror movies that would have that kind of imagery, but in their imagination, they're somehow, and I see this all the time. So I feel like little boys, it's much more common for them to be like, have like kind of these fantasies that involve some kind of violence or fighting or guns or arrows or knives or something. It's a thing.
And that's part of AJ's other stories, right, is that his father and he wrestled an alligator.
Right.
There's the whole shotguns with telescopes and hunting in the woods. And so, you know, a lot of his stories do tend to deal with this.
Girls are so much easier, man. I raised 2 girls so much easier. All right. Okay. So a little more about Dr. Fox. And the question comes to us from username Lightbulb3. A question about Dr. Linda Fox. Was her schedule checked for that day that Adriana died? Was there another child in her ER that day that could have caused her to confuse Amanda with another mom? That would seem a logical way to confirm if it's possible the doctor is confused.
Right. And so obviously the big part of this is Dr. Fox a few years later on 2020 saying... Mm-hmm. While Adriana is alive, I tell Amanda her status. I ask if she has any questions, and Amanda asks, where's the vending machine? And At trial, Dr. Fox had testified, "I knew Adriana was medevaced from out of town. I wasn't able to speak to Amanda until after I had coded her and called her, you know, declared her dead." And so this seems either made up intentionally, which I doubt, or she's confusing Amanda with someone else. And so, first of all, here's a clip of me discussing this a bit more with Amanda.
"I remember the ad litem lady was sitting beside me.
Okay.
And the doctor came in and she sat to my left. And then that was when she proceeded telling me everything that they had did, the procedures they had done, the attempts. And then when she told me that Adriana was gone, it's like they were talking, but I couldn't hear them. It's like I wasn't even there. I don't even know where they get this statement that I asked for a drink machine, because the lady had stopped to get us something to drink before we even left.
Right.
So I don't know where that come from. And then I remember them taking me out the door into where she was.
Mm-hmm.
And when they took us in, there was a male nurse in the room. And it, when I seen her, I remember feeling faint like, and I started crying, and he ultimately was the one that grabbed me and walked me over to where she was at."
Right.
You know, and Rabia, this, I mean, probably more than anything else in this case, this is the type of thing where I think people fighting their wrongful convictions face misinformation from the media.
Mm.
I mean, here it is 100% crystal clear. Dr. Fox did not speak to Amanda while she's alive.
Right.
And yet this is something repeated across social media, online, in reporting.
Yeah.
When Amanda was asked, "Do you have any questions about your daughter's status?" She asked, "Where's the vending machine?" And just that alone, the average person hears that and thinks, of course, she's a cold-blooded killer and she's guilty.
Yeah.
And it's just not true at all. And this, I don't know how the doctor came about saying this in 2020, but it's disturbing to me that this could come out.
Yeah. I mean, that 2020 interview must have been quite a while after she testified, I'm assuming, right?
Just a couple of years.
A couple of years. Well, okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, ER doctors see a lot of people. And
yeah.
I can't imagine this was malicious. I'm guessing she was just confused. I think what should have happened is that Dr. Fox should have gone back and been like, "I need to make a correction, 2020. You need to change that or put out a public statement." But we do see this over and over again. If something is, there's so many times when I'm trying to source a fact.
Oh, yeah.
And there's nowhere to source it except for another media outlet that reported it in the exact same language, it's a copy and paste, so many. And I'm talking about credible media outlets. I'm talking about actual, like, newspapers and other, like, you know, media sources that are not just, like, random blogs, but they will just copy and paste and not verify anything. So that's unfortunate. Look, by that time, obviously, you know, Amanda had already been convicted anyways, but it did not help in terms of, even with us, while we were reporting the series, people were bringing this stuff up. That, oh no, there's all this stuff of, like, why are you defending this woman who clearly was a neglectful mother and didn't love her children and all this stuff? And they're basing it on this type of stuff in the media. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why Amanda was gun shy about doing this series. Luckily, she found confidence in working with us and speaking with me, but just the way that her character had been dragged through the mud and the way in which she had been attacked as not only a killer, but a horrible mother. And that's why I think this series is so important to show, as Amanda speaks to, it is so much tougher to undo the wrongful conviction of a woman than a man, just upon the nature of the crime that you're typically dealing with. And so to be able to see everything that's been misreported and misrepresented about this case and how it was done and why it was done and show the actual truth, I think, has been, you know, very critical and important in this field.
Yeah. We did talk about this next question, but I think it's important to talk about. We did this for our Patreon bonus episode, but about AJ today and where he stands, what his relationship is with his mom and all things AJ related, because that was a question that I had and I was sad to kind of hear the answer. But Colin, why don't you let our listeners know where AJ is today?
Yeah. And so, you know, on the negative side, and this again speaks to the press reporting, which is Greg Woodfield of the Daily Mail reached out to us about speaking to AJ, and Amanda said, please don't do that. Also said it to me, please don't speak to him, even if it can help her get out. And Greg Woodfield's story is saying, you know, AJ stands behind that he saw his mom drown his sister, which is true. But he also spoke to Dr. Amanda Lewis of Georgetown, who's worked in this case for years, and said, I do stand by my testimony. At the same time, I don't remember talking to Pa Chuck in the car ride about what happened. And I recognize that when I was questioned, and I've gone back and looked at this, I was asked leading questions. There was no child expert there. And so, you know, there are obviously doubts based upon the way in which this was handled. The other side, which I think is, you know, if there's any positive to draw from this case, is that AJ, based upon this entire experience and the firefighters coming and trying to save his sister, grew up and seems well-adjusted and has become a firefighter himself to help people who are in need and distress. And so, like, that's a bit of a silver lining for both AJ and I think Amanda as well, is that he has done well and is thriving in his profession as a firefighter.
I mean, that's wonderful. Look, the nature of the case is this. If this was the kind of case where we could be like, okay, there was a murder, but somebody else was responsible, and be able to find evidence to show the family that's now estranged from the defendant, that, you know, look, there's a reason to maybe, I don't know, have some hope and trust in your loved one again and reestablish a relationship. This is so, I mean, like, because it's not like this conviction rested on somebody else's testimony. So AJ grew up thinking, well, I know my mom killed my sister because somebody else testified to that. This is him. I mean, and for him, I think it would be impossible, even if he's presented with all this other evidence that you've presented in the series, to accept it because of how it would destroy him, what it would mean to mm-hmm. him that he was directly responsible, although he really wasn't. He was a child. Right. He really wasn't. But I could assume that he would feel like he was responsible for his mother being incarcerated and taken away from him his entire life. I mean, look, to me, I'm like, Amanda's still such a wonderful mother. She's like, leave him alone. Let him live his life. Don't bring him back into this and don't hurt him. But my heart breaks. And that's why I cried a number of times while we were recording, because I think about Amanda and I think about, I mean, not only has she lost decades of her life incarcerated, she lost all of her children. She lost all of her children in one way or the other. I mean, how much more? And the world thinks of her as like a murderous mother. I mean, it's just, my God, it's just tragedy upon heartbreak upon tragedy. It's awful. So speaking of, where is Amanda today? What's happening? Let's see, and how to support her. There was a question Erica Dolan asked. Any thoughts on how we can support Amanda? Can we write to her or contribute to her commissary?
Yeah, and so for people who want to write to Amanda, you would do so through Securus Tech. So that is securustech.online/pound/login. And her identification number is Q as in quartz, 21185. For those who want to help Amanda financially, private investigator Kim Hunter, we've mentioned on the podcast, has set up a Venmo for Amanda. And that handle is at KRH0311.
When this episode airs, the new appeal will be filed in Amanda's case, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to kind of remind our listeners like where you are at with that, what that appeal is going to say and what you guys are hoping for?
Yeah. So thanks for listening to this special extra episode of Undisclosed on the Amanda Lewis case. Just to remind you all of where we stand, in early November, Amanda filed her appeal alleging 4 separate grounds for her conviction being thrown out. We will be back next week with a very special guest to speak in more depth about the Amanda Lewis case. Next time on Undisclosed.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, it's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. As you know, we did something new a few months ago by utilizing SpeakPipe as a way for you guys to leave us voice notes. For anyone new here, you can go to speakpipe.com/undisclosed to leave us your questions or thoughts and comments. Since the response to SpeakPipe has been so amazing, we've got 2 additional exciting announcements to make. First, we have a new Facebook community group where you can engage with us and one another about all things true crime and criminal justice. Just go to facebook.com/groups/toward justice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. In addition to that, We also just relaunched our Patreon page at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. So many folks have already signed up, and we can't express our gratitude enough to each and every single one of you. Even a dollar goes a long way and allows us to do the work pro bono for our defendants. Also, I would like to give a quick shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production, as well as Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. To engage with us on social media, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. You can find us on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're new or a returning listener, you can check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our revamped website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can follow Rabia at Rabia2, the number 2, on Instagram, and Colin at evidenceprof on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for your continued support for us and for supporting our sponsors. Until next time.